grown and at about the same level of development? Certainly, you will draw blanks from many clients with this sort of question, but once in a while, you will uncover a gem of information. I once had a client, Laura, who was in a current life that was designed around the probability she would lose her second son, Jason, age 18, in a drowning accident. Jason's soul was a member of Laura's primary soul group, a companion soul who was very close to her. This soul volunteered to live only 18 years, if such indications were realized, because that allotment of time was enough for Jason to complete certain tasks and fulfill a karmic lesson for Laura. During the process of Laura's life selection, it was decided that she needed a lifetime of emotional support from a strong soul whose immortal character was much like her own. A kindred spirit was chosen from a secondary group some distance away from her primary group. This affiliated soul took the role of Laura's eldest son, Steve. While Steve and his mother had many battles in his teens because they were so much alike, he was there for Laura when Jason died, and his father left the family as an outgrowth of all the trauma and grief. Laura's perceptions about the scheme of things and Steve's role were greatly enhanced by these revelations. Below are samples of other questions about nearby affiliated soul groups you might consider. 1. What are your connections with souls from other groups in the same vicinity of your primary group? 2. Do you personally have any association with certain souls in another cluster group? 3. Are the other groups around you generally of a more advanced nature, or are they less developed than your own group? 4. Could you tell me how the origin of your group compares with others in your general spatial area? 5. Do you know if your guide participates with guides of other groups for activities of mutual benefit between various groups? Clients in the intermediate and advanced levels. An absence of orientation is one of the first indications that your client has advanced beyond their original group of souls. Another sign of soul advancement occurs at reentry when you ask them to identify lights in the distance. Under the section First Contact with Spirits, Part 4, I discussed elements of the color white pertaining to younger souls. Occasionally, you will have a client who says, "I see a cluster of small flickering white lights waiting for me." This usually means one thing. You have a more advanced teaching soul who wishes to see their students before anyone else. Typically, these lights represent very young souls who have not yet begun their incarnations, and your client is one of their student teachers. Playful, humorous souls who are considered to be children souls often appear as small, dancing white lights. These young souls display innocence and exuberance and are easily distracted. Being a student teacher usually means the client is part of an independent study group of developing teachers who will someday be full-fledged guides. However, if you have a more advanced client who is not a student teacher, they won't see the lights of younger souls waiting for them, and there will be no need for deviation on the trip inward. The non-teacher advanced client will generally go directly to a space where they are able to rejoin peers in their independent study group. If any of your clients are rather new to this level of advancement, say level 3, there could be some initial confusion in their minds as to the whereabouts of their primary group. This is because they see none of their old soul companions, with the possible exception of one or two original friends. Be aware that souls in transition to level 3 may see both their primary group and a specialized independent study group. Discussing the character makeup of each of these groups will help you and your client differentiate one from another. Souls in primary groups at levels 1 and 2 are made up of beings who have differences in talent, interest, and motivation towards certain activities. However, once a soul evolves into the intermediate and upper levels of knowledge, wisdom, and experience, they are often matched with like-minded souls from other primary cluster groups. It is at level 3 where specialization begins for souls in training for such activities as teachers, life form designers, explorer souls, and library archivists. If your client is rather new to the intermediate levels, They may be alternating their time about equally between the old and the new group. An independent study group, focusing on one skill, usually consists of far fewer souls than primary groups. Despite this, a rather new level 3 might not recognize all their new colleagues right away. However, if your client has progressed into a solid level 4, they should recognize the advanced souls with whom they work more quickly. I should add that advanced souls still maintain contact with their old primary soul companions during activity periods that do not involve specialization training. For additional information regarding more advanced souls, I recommend a review of chapters 10 and 11 in Journey of Souls and chapter 8 in Destiny of Souls. I have found with the more advanced souls at this stage in their session may be a good time to discuss just what they are studying before moving on to scenes with their counsel. This is an appropriate moment to consult with the advancing client about their aspirations, ideals, and goals as a spirit. Taking clients before their counsel. There are many open-ended questions that can be asked of the soul following a cluster group visit in terms of where to travel next. Depending on the degree of resistance, perhaps only the first or second question following will be necessary. 1. Where would you like us to go now? 2. Do you wish to stay with your cluster group and engage in some sort of activity with them? 3. Are you ready to move off to some specific kind of activity that is most important? The last question is an open invitation to discuss the counsel. There are no firm spiritual rules of procedure connected to the timing of counsel visits. Following re-entry, the average client will be ready to visit a collective of higher beings soon after returning to their cluster group. Even so, you must be prepared for alternatives to this normal pattern. Counsel meetings can come before or after group homecomings, time in solitary reflection, library study, or a classroom experience. The same client may have different counsel schedules, depending on the life just completed. Be aware that you will have clients who seem somewhat disoriented by the sequence of spiritual events following life. I commented earlier about subjects who get bogged down at the gateway into the spirit world and require a little nudging to move forward. While the gateway is a particular trouble spot for client disorientation or even obstruction, confusion can happen any time in the session. For instance, if your subject seems stuck right after visiting their primary group, I might say, "Is anything confusing to you at the moment that you would like to tell me about?" If a long pause brings no results, my follow-up question would probably be more specific. "Do you think this is an appropriate time for us to move to the space where you have the honor to appear before a group of wise beings who are waiting to help you?" Most people nod their head and say, "Yes." Indeed, by asking this question, I know it looks as though I am shamelessly leading the client. From long experience, I have learned with some clients that some sort of encouragement is necessary at certain stages in the session. I believe my subjects see such prodding statements by me as an affirmation of their own knowledge and capacity to report about the spirit world. I have previously mentioned that gentle direction at appropriate times also gives the client confidence that you are a knowledgeable spiritual traveler. A client may say, "No, I am not ready to see my counsel," or, "I don't see myself going in front of a counsel." There could be a number of reasons for this kind of resistance. Usually this means that there were major karmic problems in the last life. The best plan for the LBL facilitator is to simply be encouraging without forcing the issue. Another reason for a client not wanting to recapture the memory of their last counsel meeting is that they have not yet met the expectations agreed upon at this meeting. Since the spirit world always exists in now time, clients who hypnotically re-enter this realm may judge themselves on their current life and thus become resistant to another counsel visitation. This is not common. Fortunately, I find that of those clients who are somewhat resistant about visiting their counsel, few remain so for very long. The attraction to the counsel is potent. Many clients are so caught up with the positive aspects of what they always receive at council meetings that they refuse to go anywhere until they have had their chance for a council review. Apparently all souls visit members of their council at least once between lives, and this usually happens not too long after their return from an incarnation. By far, this first meeting has the greatest effect on a soul because it involves evaluations of their progress. However, be prepared for some clients to pay a second visit to the council just before or after body selection as they get ready for a new life. There seems to be no particular pattern for a soul having one or two visits between their lives. The soul may have had an especially difficult time with a past life, but I suspect the magnitude of severity or karmic complexity of the next life plays a major part in the council's decision to have the soul come for a second visit. It is possible the soul has had a long history of making the same mistakes, and thus additional reinforcing may be required by the soul's council just before rebirth. The level of the soul is also a consideration because younger souls naturally require more support from guides and their council. Most clients have profound feelings for the members of their council. Often I hear the term elder used to describe a council member, but other common identifications are the wise ones, the sacred committee, the planners, and so on. I always begin this series of council questions with 1. By what name do you wish me to call these beings? When a client tells me they are ready to go before this body, I will inquire, 2. Do you go with someone or by yourself? A majority of clients respond that their guide will accompany them, especially the level 1 and 2 souls. I now ask, 3. Please describe your travel route. I would like to know what you see and do along the way and what happens when you arrive. The trip never seems to last long, and clients have the feeling that their council is not too far away from the location of their cluster group. A review of Chapter 6, The Council of Elders, in Destiny of Souls, will demonstrate my findings about typical council settings and how they usually appear to people in trance. Often clients will describe a domed structure, which I feel is symbolic of an earthly spiritual shrine, temple, or even a hall of justice. Nevertheless, in no way do people see this enclosure as a courtroom with judges. This is an important distinction, since clients describe their visions of spiritual structures using symbolic comparisons to images familiar to them on earth. In the minds of clients, the council chamber represents a holy place of reverence. I am not being overly dramatic when I say that people who are still incarnating believe that when they are in a council chamber, they are close to God or the Source. From a theoretical standpoint, I feel it is not a coincidence that most everyone sees a large spherical room for the council meetings. This circular, unbroken shape utilizes a concentrated energy field of superior thought where no energy escapes. The contained, refined energy is projected outward from the elders and surrounds the still incarnating soul with encouragement and enlightenment. I suspect the ringed design of the place of life selection has similar properties of powerful energy containment, but for a different use involving directors who focus timeline images for souls. The moment the soul enters the council chamber, their guide appears nearby, usually in back of them. On some occasions, I have had advanced souls who have entered the enclosure alone. Their guide is already in the room. Souls consider a council member or elder to be a step or two above a senior guide. Your client will feel in awe of these wise beings. Sometimes you may sense a little anxiety in the voice of your client during their trip to the chamber. There are those souls who are bubbling over with anticipation, while others approach the council with quiet, serene contemplation. As the client enters the council chamber, I will ask this question. 4. How many beings do you see waiting for you? It is common for clients to respond by giving me a number between 3 and 10. The average is 5 to 7. Occasionally, a client might say that they see more than 10 elders. This is rare. While a larger number of council elders in attendance can mean a more advanced soul is coming before them, you should be cautious in accepting a number higher than 10. Besides a simple visual mistake, a large council gathering could also indicate they are having some sort of dialogue with each other, perhaps about a prior soul, that does not relate to your client's case. While you must be careful not to invalidate client statements, I do find that repeating question 4 as the client draws closer may reveal that some elders are leaving. If they all stay, some won't seem to be participating in the upcoming proceedings with your client. When the client approaches closer to the space where they will be interviewed, I'll continue with my series of questions about the council. These inquiries are not necessarily listed in an order suitable for every client, and inevitably there will be variations depending upon the circumstances of individual council meetings. 5. I would like you to describe to me just how you are feeling right now. This all-inclusive question should be asked more than once if necessary and at any time during the proceedings. 6. Is your guide in the chamber? If so, where is this guide located in relation to you? Most guides stand in back and slightly to the left or right of the soul. Sometimes, with a more advanced client, the guide is adjacent to the council or even on the council. 7. Where do you position yourself in relation to your council? Most souls appear to move to a place directly in front. 8. Are you going to stand or will you sit? Almost always, souls will stand in front of the elders. 9. Let's check again on exactly how many beings are here waiting for you. Please count them from left to right. 10. Are they standing or sitting? 11. If they are sitting down, please describe any sort of furniture you see in front of them. The average client visualizes the elders sitting at a long, curved, or rectangular table. 12. Is the council positioned slightly above you on some sort of dais, or are they at eye level, directly in front of you? More often than not, the elders are at eye level. The reason I am engaged with small details at this point is that I want to get my client accustomed to observing and reporting everything that is going on in a step-by-step fashion. This is a warm-up for a very significant meeting, and my questions will become more rigorous. 13. Look closely. Do you see any gender characteristics among the council members? Can you identify the number of beings who appear as male or female, or are they all androgynous? Frankly, many clients see their council composed of elderly males, which is a cultural stereotype representing wisdom. The more advanced souls will report genderless council members. They may also appear as elongated, translucent light forms. 14. Describe to me how each member is dressed. When council members appear as human forms, they generally have robes. I will question the meaning associated with the color of these garments. Sometimes they are all dressed in white, clarity of thought, or purple, wisdom. But they may be dressed in a variety of individual colors that could indicate a particular talent or specialty, such as green for an elder who was a healer. The meaning of certain robe colors may also relate directly to a soul's character, or even the lack of an individual trait that is important for the soul to acquire for continued development. 15. Do you have the sense that one elder will serve as a chairperson, moderator, or director of these proceedings? Everyone could be an equal participant, but typically one council member will direct the agenda. If the client tells me there is a director, I will ask, where is this being located in relation to the others? Almost always, the answer is, in the center. If there is a director, one or two others may make comments, but rarely does every panel member address the soul, unless the council has less than 4 members. Moreover, you will have some clients who see the director as displaying a light which is larger and brighter than the other council members. If this is the case, I would ask, Does larger and brighter mean this elder is more powerful than the rest? You'll be told something to the effect, "No, it's so I will pay more attention to this being and what he is saying to me." 16. Is anyone wearing any sort of ornament or emblem you can identify? This question refers to the fact that many clients see one or more council members wearing medallions around their neck or rings with precious stones. The stone colors denote specific concepts relating to the soul. I refer you to Destiny of Souls, Chapter 6, where I discuss signs and symbols in the spirit world. If only one panel member is wearing a medallion or ornament, it is frequently the moderator. 17. I want you to describe the design on this medallion and give me the meaning of what you see. Some clients will tell you they cannot make out any lines or designs on these emblems. I always explain to the client that council members are not wearing these ornaments out of vanity or to indicate some sort of authority to impress the soul. These symbols have meaning to the soul and are reminders of a soul's personal power, potential, and karmic goals. Therefore, I will instruct my client to look closer and to begin by telling me if the medallion, typically depicted as round and metal, is gold, silver, or bronze, and if it is the size of a plum, orange, or grapefruit, and then ask them once again to describe the design and its meaning. Other peripheral questions that might be asked at this early phase are 18. Does the number and makeup of your council change after each life? 19. Is there anything different about the surroundings here since your last visit? 20. Do you have the sense your council is going to be easy on you this time, or do they appear rather severe? This last query about the demeanor of the elders is a leading question, designed to encourage a strong counter-response. I have never seen any evidence of jarring or harsh treatment from the elders. On occasion, a council member may initially appear to my client as very serious or intense in their questioning, but they are not austere or dictatorial. Council members can be challenging, but they are not argumentative or judgmental. It is my impression the council is guided by a desire to assist the soul in an atmosphere of love, compassion, and understanding. I hope that a counter-response from a protesting client over my asking question 20 about severity will produce more information than I might otherwise receive. When I know the council meeting is ready to get underway, I ask this question. 21. What is the first thing you hear in your mind, and which elder addresses you? Normally at this stage, there will be a welcoming statement from the director or chairperson, and then some sort of opening exchange will follow in a slow, gentle manner, as in the following. Elder, so, you are with us again. Welcome back. Soul, I'm glad to be back. Elder, good. Now tell us how you feel about your last life. Soul, I think it was all right, but I guess I could have done much better. Elder, in what way do you see that you could have done more for yourself and others? In Journey of Souls, there is a case quote that I always try to remember when I have clients before their council. The elders are all-knowing about my entire span of lives, but they are not as directive as one might think. They want my input to assess my motivations and strength of resolve. Another case example indicating the way in which council evaluations are conducted is as follows. When the elders begin to talk to me, there is an initial greeting, and I am asked to express my thoughts about my progress. My guide is mentally helping me, but he does not interfere. My participation in the events of my last life are reviewed and compared to my actions with similar events in my other lives. The elders seem to be evaluating how my host bodies worked to benefit or hinder me, and maybe they are considering the type of body appropriate to my next test. I am questioned about my motivation and goals, and if I am happy. There is a give and take between us because nothing can be hidden from them. The council is aware of all my good and bad character traits. They are encouraging and telling me not to be too hard on myself. Besides the multitude of questions you will want to ask during soul elder exchanges, I will list some of my own you might consider. 22. Is there a reason why a particular elder is on your panel? 23. Does one panel member have a certain area of expertise or special interest when they question you that relates directly to your own interests and experience? 24. What do the elders say about your progress that was not discussed with your guide in orientation or at any other time? 25. During these proceedings, does your guide have any input about your progress? 26. What is your opinion about the elders' general attitude toward the way you lived your last life? 27. Do the council members make any comments about your current state of advancement compared to all your former lives? 28. In terms of evaluation, does anyone on the council offer constructive criticism or a specific encouragement toward you? 29. Are the statements given to you by this council any different from other council meetings you have attended after former lives? 30. What are your overall feelings about yourself as the council meeting draws to a close? 31. Is there anything else you wish to say to your director or chairperson before we leave the council chamber? What message is being given to you that could be useful in your current life? I never end a council meeting without asking question 31, because so much can be learned about your client's life today in the timeless spiritual atmosphere of this visualization. On the return trip back to the cluster, I often have interesting exchanges with my clients. It is a time of processing, and they are in a reflective mood. It is strange, but quite often guides do not accompany the soul back to their clusters. My subjects don't seem to know why, but I suspect their guides may be engaged with matters relating to the just-completed meeting. Sometimes on these return trips, I will ask a client, "Do any other members of your group go before the same council?" Typically, soul companions go before different councils. This probably has to do with the differences between soul character, talent, and motivations, especially at the lower levels of advancement. Another point I should mention is that souls do not appear to discuss these proceedings later with their friends. It is considered too private a matter for public discussion, as well as a violation of trust between the soul and their council. Therapeutic opportunities during council visitations. While your client is in the council meeting room, you might ask the question, "Do you think there is a higher being in this room at a greater level than the elders?" I have had clients describe a presence whom they consider a superior, godlike source that monitors the council itself. Those clients who do have this acute awareness are profoundly moved. I give case examples of reports about the presence in Chapter 6 of Destiny of Souls. When your client is undergoing interviews by the wise beings who probably placed them on Earth, it is one of the most meaningful aspects of the entire session. The psychological benefits are enormous. This is because the client is both an observer using the mind of their current body, as well as a participant utilizing their immortal soul mind. You will find similar, but not with quite the same impact, insightful opportunities exist later in the space of life selection, when your client chooses their body. The overall individual guidance offered by our guides is vital to a soul's well-being, yet I believe the interviews of a single council meeting greatly exceed that of orientation debriefings after a life, because council meetings are so far-reaching in terms of spiritual planning and management. When the elders are reviewing the progress of the souls who come before them, their keen evaluations encompass the soul's entire existence. You are able to look at highlights of many past life scripts through the interactions between a client and council members. As old memories resurface, your client's perceptions about who they really are as an immortal being will be of great consequence in the process of self-discovery. In my view, There is a privacy of the mind that is released from a superconscious soul state which transcends other forms of therapy. While in a deep trance state in front of our counsel, the conscious mind is much less inhibited by disclosure. This is because the soul mind is interacting with the human brain to provide basic truths about one's real self. Clients are less afraid to admit the secrets they know to be true about their character when reporting to you about their experiences before a group of wise, benevolent advisors. However, having said all this, I want to make it clear that your client will not be able to recall intimate details of their counsel meeting. I suspect some of this blockage of total recall is by design, because the client is not spiritually ready in their current life to receive it. Other aspects of a counsel meeting may not be revealed because the client is not psychologically prepared. The LBL therapist should seek to determine if client resistance to recall during a counsel meeting is elder-directed or is information being withheld from a desire by the client to avoid painful analyzation of mistakes and shortcomings. Be aware that both elders and guides are apparently able to screen the thoughts they transmit to the returning soul as well. This will reduce your client's ability to reconstruct a complete picture of what is going on at all times during the council meeting. I have had only a very few highly advanced clients who were able to pick up any conversation between council members that were not expressly directed to the soul. Here is an unusual example. Dr. N. While you are communicating with the director of your council, what do you think is transpiring between the other members? Subject. They communicate with each other to compare examples of other cases like mine. Dr. N. Please explain this further. Subject. I can't read much, but they seem to be comparing methods which have worked with other souls to determine what might be the best approach for me in my next body. Dr. N. As you listen, do you find this information helpful to you in any way? Subject. Not really. The communication is too abstract and rapid, and I only can catch fragments between the mental barriers. Besides, I must keep my attention focused on the director. In the spirit world, the power of soul blocking with telepathic communications and, conversely, the ability to read through the blocks of others, seem to increase with soul advancement. Certainly the elders do block most of their communication between themselves from souls who appear before them. To me, this seems a bit unfair to the still incarnating soul, but my clients feel comforted that what they are supposed to know will eventually be revealed to them. It is not easy for the spiritual regressionist to determine if certain details are being blocked by the client or the elders themselves. Selective amnesia exists within each client. I have come to believe that what a client is supposed to know at this juncture in their life will be uncovered during the session. The rest must come from within each client to be released later in life at the proper time. While I believe it is the task of LBL therapists to work as hard as they can to extract information when the clients are in the presence of teachers, there are boundaries. Once in a great while I hear of an inexperienced or unprofessional hypnotherapist who will try to evoke responses from an unsuspecting subject by improperly encouraging transference and engaging in projection and counter-transference. During hypnosis, when the subject experiences a temporary displacement of feelings onto the therapist, this is transference. There are susceptible clients, especially those with unresolved emotional attitudes connected with early bonding experiences in childhood, who wish to please the therapist and essentially make them a parent. Thus, transference becomes a dependency issue. For instance, a client may project the following: I see you, the facilitator, in my spirit group. Since the odds against this are astronomical, my suggestion is to always assume such a statement is an initial knee-jerk reaction relating to their warm feelings about you. As an LBL professional, you represent a trusted spiritual advisor who is engaged in connecting people to their spiritual history. My advice is to gently remind your client that finding you in their spirit group is highly doubtful, considering there must be billions of soul groups involving people on Earth. Thank them for the compliment, and explain that you have heard this before from others, and it would be a good idea to take a closer look at each member of their soul group. It is best to remove this misinterpretation as rapidly as possible. Countertransference results when an inept therapist feeds into this dependency need by encouraging their subject's transference and by projecting themselves into client visualizations. My worst example of this sort of practice in LBL work would be, "Do you see me on your council?" Another is, "Do you see me as one of your spirit guides?" Perhaps a facilitator with a poor ego structure feels dissatisfied with what the client is producing, or they may want to project their own wishes onto the subject, or feel in some misguided way that they are nurturing. In any case, this clumsy approach not only displays professional ignorance, but is unethical and a violation of trust. Fortunately, these circumstances are rare, and the large majority of subjects are both cognitive and too independent of spirit to allow a facilitator to project themselves into scenes. Spiritual regression connects both parties at various energy levels, and therefore when transference problems arise, they inhibit a free, unbiased flow of information unless shut down immediately. Nevertheless, there is no reason why an LBL therapist should be inhibited entirely from personalizing questions to advance the spiritual regression session. About the time when a council meeting is getting underway, I might ask, "Why do you feel at this point in your life these wise teachers have mentally encouraged you to seek out my assistance in helping you access information about your soul life?" This inquiry invites thoughts of synchronicity, that is, events that come together at a certain time for a reason. Most clients pause before they answer this question, and I will not speak again until they do. I have mentioned that subjects in hypnosis respond slowly to probing questions because they are receiving more thoughts and experiencing greater imagery than what they are reporting to you. It is best to be very patient. It is true that you could ask the conscious client during intake what they specifically want to know from their counsel about their current life. However, I feel the broader issue of why a client is seeking spiritual guidance through your facilitation at this time in their life will have more relevance if this question is addressed in front of the elders. Of course, every client has ongoing core issues, but many are at a crossroads when they come to see you. Are they going to continue with the same pattern of living? Or are they ready to make positive mental changes? In my own practice, I often hear the remark, "I thought I really needed to see you last year during a crisis, but now is a better time because I am calmer and more reflective." Clients do feel a sense of purpose about their session. This becomes evident during council meetings with both elders and guides present because they are a soul's primary guardians. I should also add that many clients have observed that my own guide was in the office assisting me from behind my chair. There have been times when I felt this as well. With regard to addressing issues in a client's current life, one should understand that in the spirit world, souls exist in now time, which is not limited by timelines and therefore is not absolute. This will be especially helpful to you during council meetings. I remind my subjects that the beauty of now time in the spirit world is that I am able to move them forward, backward, or suspend the council proceedings temporarily. This is an excellent therapeutic tool during spiritual regression. For example, in the middle of a council meeting, we may be having a discussion about making choices in life. I can freeze the action and place the meeting on hold while taking my client to the place of life selection to discuss choices that were made about their current body, and then return them to the council. This gives the meeting more depth. You may also wish to suspend the council to transport your client to some significant event in their current life or any other life that has direct relevance to a specific topic under discussion. Since council meetings take place after a past life, the events that have brought an inquiring client to you have technically not yet happened in current linear time. This does not limit current life therapy. Because the spirit world exists in a timeless domain where all possible nows abide together, the sequence of physical and biological events from one former body to a new current body poses no restrictions for analysis. I often say, Look carefully at your counsel right now and tell me how they feel you are doing at this time in your current life. With the subject's soul fully exposed to the scrutiny of the elders, this question presents an opportunity for the spiritual regressionist to uncover the deeper issues surrounding self-concept. At this juncture, it is fitting that we try to clarify misperceptions, assist clients in identifying what is unique about them, help them come to a greater understanding about patterns of behavior, and foster an awareness to make optimal use of their strengths and weaknesses. I feel clients in a superconscious trance state are better able to interpret their own internal behavior through increased insight. I know that I am only an intermediary for more powerful spiritual forces in my clients' existence. People ask, if time in the spirit world is not an absolute, can we see into the future as well as the past in a superconscious state? It is possible to a small degree with a few clients, but progression, in my view, is unreliable. The reason seeing into the future from a current life is generally not possible goes to issues of self-discovery, free will, and non-deterministic paths of choice. I'll have more to say about future time progression under life and body selection later in Part 5. Before closing these sections on council meetings, I should add that even though you decide to take your client to the place of life selection in the middle of a council meeting, this does not preclude you from doing so again in more detail later as the session draws to a close. In many cases, you will find it meaningful for the client to return once more to the place of life selection for more thorough discussions about their current body choice. As I've said before, subjects in LBL regression do not necessarily visualize an orderly progression through the spirit world, consisting of going to orientations, encountering friends, and meeting members of their council. Having the flexibility and creativity to move your subject back and forth in different spatial areas at appropriate moments in the session will serve you well. Reviewing past life incarnations. With many LBL cases, the best time to discuss a client's former incarnations is either during a council meeting or right afterward. However, what if your client finds themselves in a library, a classroom, or a space of solitude? Places of this nature are equally suitable to discuss past life highlights. Reviewing certain aspects of significant past lives in your client's history, in conjunction with their greater understanding of soul character, is therapeutically important. The client is brought to a greater awareness of their identity and the fact that they are a unique being. The immortal character of souls is shaped by the direction of will, desire, and imagination, while being influenced in actions and deeds from many bodies. I want to know about the effects and end result from this past life behavior. Human society, especially in areas of high population, can cause one to feel isolated, empty, and unable to commit if we are not sure who we are in the scheme of things. A vital component to reviewing past lives is uncovering a client's true identity by analyzing a variety of bodies. I have a series of questions for the client in this regard. 1. How much is your soul ego influenced by the brain of each body you choose? Do some bodies make it more difficult than others to maintain your permanent identity? 2. What is your most important individual characteristic as a soul that defines the real you that would be carried from life to life? 3. Do you choose to be one gender more than another in your lives? 4. Are you attracted to being in bodies in certain parts of the world for cultural and geographic reasons? 5. What sort of life are you most comfortable living? 6. Of all your past lives, tell me what life was the most significant and productive. By bringing in your client's personal identification with former bodies, it is easier to understand why certain choices were made in other lifetimes that might relate to their current life. I look for the expression of satisfaction when a particular effect is achieved, or disappointment when it is not achieved in these lifetimes. You may find that those clients who come to you with past life regression experience probably have not been asked relevant questions about their soul identity in all these different bodies. An LBL session will add dimension to these earlier past life sessions. In condensing past life reviews with a full LBL regression, I might touch on a couple of significant lives with an overview approach. In this context, there is one question I always ask of everyone. 8. When was your first life on Earth? Having some familiarity with the history of world civilizations and their rise and fall is invaluable. Your client might respond to the first life question by describing membership in a Stone Age tribe some 50,000 to 100,000 years ago in the Paleolithic era. Another client will see themselves in a Neolithic period, perhaps 5,000 to 10,000 years ago. Many clients remember their first life as being in the early civilizations of Egypt and Mesopotamia, perhaps 3,000 to 5,000 years ago. Unless you have a very young soul with few past lives, your client will probably not be able to remember most of their past lives, except those where they experienced their greatest accomplishments. Even so, most people can recall their first life on Earth. What about visitations to Earth by the souls of your clients who were in alien bodies? While you will have hybrid souls whose early physical incarnations were on other planets before coming to Earth, it is very rare to have a client who actually visited Earth in an alien body. They may have been engaged in some sort of colonization attempt early in our cultural history, or just made a brief visit. Out of all my cases, I have had only a handful of such people. I wrote an article about these anomalies in my practice for Fate magazine in the March 2001 issue. When you ask the question, "Where are you during your first life on Earth?" be prepared for some clients to declare, "I'm in Atlantis." I've discussed the Atlantis attraction syndrome earlier in Part 3 under Checking Conscious Interference relating to preconceived bias. This lost eighth continent was thought to exist around 10,000 years ago. I am curious about this legend myself, but I am also skeptical. While I must acknowledge an Atlantis could have existed on Earth in some form, it still falls under the heading of unproven mythology. Without negating initial reactions from some clients about having a life in Atlantis, I want LBL therapists to know that it is quite possible you are dealing with a hybrid soul in these situations. I have many references to hybrids listed in Destiny of Souls. Clients who have the feeling their first lives were in Atlantis may actually be hybrid souls who had thousands of years of prior incarnations on a physical world resembling the geographic legend of Atlantis. These lives ended for the soul before they began coming to Earth. I have not found that we have intermittent lives on other planets between our Earth lives. When working with a hybrid soul, you could face psychological challenges. These people may not have made healthy adjustments to life on Earth. Their association with a human brain and the heavy energy density of the human body could still be daunting. I have had clients who feel their Earth body is alien. The incidence of suicide among hybrids in their first lives on Earth is higher than non-hybrids. If you do have a hybrid soul as a client, there are certain basic questions you will want to ask about their experiences on an alien world. 1. Can you tell me if this planet is part of our universe or in another dimension? 2. If it is in our universe, could this planet be in our own Milky Way galaxy and perhaps near Earth? 3. Does it still exist, and what is its name? 4. Is it a physical or a mental world? A. If a mental world, describe this world and your place in it. B. If a physical world, would you say this world was larger or smaller than the size of Earth? 5. Please compare the topography of this world to Earth in terms of mountains, deserts, oceans, and atmosphere. 6. If this planet had organic life, what was the most intelligent form? Usually this form was the client's body while incarnating. 7. Tell me what you looked like on this planet. What were your thoughts, and what were your range of activities? 8. Why did you stop incarnating on this world and decide to come to Earth? 9. Explain the differences in mental makeup between your body on this alien world and your human body on Earth. 10. Compare the technology of this world to Earth. 11. Is there anyone in your lives on Earth who is with you on this world? In your review of past lives, sometimes you will wonder about the possibility of outside influences on those clients who claim that all their incarnations were on Earth. Here are 2 case quotes as examples. A. In my early lives on Earth, I wanted to cause a shift of consciousness from this primitive brain to make it more human. B. One of my significant early lives was just before the last ice age, 25,000 years ago, where I raised the consciousness of my tribe by discovering an herb mixed with a mineral which calmed the nervous system and sharpened perceptions of the brain. This made my people less primitive and more rational. In summary, keep in mind that all past life experiences affect soul development, some more than others. However, it is while a subject is visualizing life in the spirit world that we can help them correlate the lessons from these experiences into their life today. The choice of each body in each lifetime is actually the psychological sum of all previous body choices, both here and on other planets. At the beginning of part 4 in this text, I discussed the occasional need to desensitize trauma from past life death scenes before regressing clients into the spirit world. There is no question former negative body imprints can affect the lives of some people today. Having said that, I believe this area of past life therapy has been dramatically overblown, while the healing properties of life between lives has not been given due consideration. This is because LBL therapy is a new field. There are highly qualified past life therapists who have strong opinions about the effects of psychological damage to a soul from former lives that has been transmitted into a current body. They place heavy emphasis on current mental distress involving fear and anger originating from being a victim in some lives, and guilt over being a perpetrator of wrongdoing in others. They take this idea further with a belief that residuals of negative karmic patterns still exist, even though the lessons have been learned and therefore must be expunged. This is an old concept that requires re-examination. Tibetan mysticism and Eastern religious philosophy declare that our consciousness is influenced by what is called dependent origination. Samskaras is a term the ancients used to describe negative karmic patterns that pass from body to body and plague one's psyche. These doctrines have influenced past life therapy. I would argue that the ancients did not possess the cognitive knowledge we have today about the spirit world. Many past life practitioners, not familiar with LBL therapy, failed to take into consideration that negative thoughts and feelings from our past lives are largely healed between lives in the spirit world. It is easy to blame the problems that trouble us on negative past life imprints. Frankly, even during the busiest years of my practice, I found only a low percentage of clients were seriously affected by past life body imprints. If this is true, then why are souls so often conflicted? I feel the answer lies in the fact that for many people, mental distress is the result of a difficult soul-body connection. I will review this aspect of LBL therapy in more detail in my section on Connections Between the Body and Soul later in Part 5. Surveying Other Spirit World Activities. At some point after your client's council visit and before their transition to the space of life selection, I suggest asking a catch-all question. Would you provide me with details of your other activities in the spirit world? I am thinking of those periods when you are not being evaluated by counselors or undergoing specific training. Perhaps we could start with your most favorite recreational activity. In Chapter 7 in Destiny of Souls under Recreational Activities, There are many sections dealing with a variety of soul activities you might wish to review from time to time for ideas. Of course, what one client considers recreation, another might feel is a training activity. The following is a list of spiritual activity categories that could prove fruitful in your investigations. A. Areas inside the spirit world where souls are trained to use their energy creatively. B. Areas outside the spirit world, which could include uninhabited physical worlds where souls can practice their skills in manipulating energy to create both animate and inanimate objects. C. Areas in other dimensions, including mental worlds, where souls travel to study or play. D. Areas that are communal, where souls may go for pure recreation, involving singing, dancing, telling stories, and playing games. E. Areas of solitude for study and reflection. F. Areas of assembly, where souls gather with others in activities such as listening to lectures by roving teachers. There are many varieties of inquiry within these general categories. An example would be expanding Category C, about interdimensional travel, with these questions. Why are you an interdimensional traveler? Is our reality combined within the same dimensional space as another reality? How many dimensions are you able to visit, and what is the difference between them and our universe? Do you see and interact with other intelligent beings in these interdimensional realities? Are you involved with both physical and mental dimensions? If so, describe the differences. Assisting a client in the examination of a full range of activities will reveal many aspects of their character and level of advancement. Clients whose souls are solidly in level 3 and above are probably specializing in some activity which suits their talents, interests, and experience. I have outlined some of these specialty areas in Chapter 8, under the Advancing Soul and Destiny of Souls. Reviewing your client's spirit world activities also enables you to check the levels of collective progress with their spiritual companions. In this context, I would draw your attention to an activity I call spiritual psychodrama between soul companions that can produce a mine of information. I suppose psychodrama could come under the category of classroom activities, but I often see this work conducted away from classroom settings and teachers. It has the appearance of a study group with the evaluation of performance conducted by peers. You will have clients who do not engage in psychodrama in soul groups, but the ones that do find it very instructive in comparing their behavior in a physical body with friends. I think this activity is worthy of particular attention in LBL therapy. You might begin your inquiry with this question. Do you engage in any activity in the spirit world with your friends where you evaluate each other's performance from the previous life? There are soul groups who engage in the practice of role-playing where they recreate their physical lives, with each soul companion assuming different roles. It is rather like a room full of people playing duplicate bridge. This is done to see who can employ the best strategy for the most productive life. One soul companion will challenge another to switch roles in the same body as a means of comparison, with the judges being their friends. While psychodrama is looked upon as a game with a lot of teasing and fun, it is also instructive. The whole exercise is designed for souls to better understand how certain bodies and minds are selected for particular tasks in a given set of circumstances. The recreation of interactive scenes allows you to sit in while your client and their soul companions study all the major variables in any given former life situation. Naturally, a number of former predicaments involving problem-solving relate to current client issues. There are many conclusions you could draw from listening to a scene involving psychodrama. Here are three examples. 1. Did your client act as a lone wolf or function in collaboration with others when there was a difficult choice to be made at a crossroads in life? 2. Was this choice motivated by self-interest or predicated by a desire to bring positive change into the situation, especially if it involved the lives of others? 3. In what ways has your client's responses to difficult situations, especially those involving relationships, changed in their current life as a result of new perceptions gained from psychodrama after former lives. You will find that many of the actors in this spirit world play are on stage again with meaningful roles in your client's current life drama. When searching for clues relating to particular issues in your client's life, it is wise to pay attention to all aspects of their spirit world activities. Every client has a different twist to their spiritual memories. A line of inquiry could work well for one client, but not for another. You will have clients who have only hazy memories about their spiritual life away from guides and elders, while others will give graphic details about many things, providing you ask. Never forget that the average client does not automatically volunteer information. In any session, it is easy to miss a signpost if you are not methodical in your questioning. I will give a case illustration of a near oversight on my part involving spiritual activities. I was about ready to bring Jack's LBL session to a close when I asked him, as an afterthought, "Was there any sort of instruction we missed between your last life and current life that you were supposed to be working on today?" After a long pause, Jack said, "Oh, I guess you must mean that time when I sat in on a visiting lecturer's class with 15 other souls I didn't know." I had no idea what Jack was talking about, but I replied in my most confident manner, "Yes, that class. On the count of three, I want you to return to this class and tell me all about it. 1, 2, 3. Jack then told me he was asked to attend a what-if class conducted in an assembly area that looked like a small Greco-Roman temple with circular seats. An instructor was in the center. The what-if drill consisted of the instructor asking each soul in attendance what they would do in a particular circumstance during an incarnation. When Jack's turn came, I really did not know what to expect. His face grew dark and he spoke in a halting voice, "Oh, that's it. Mine was about kindness to animals, and I'm falling down. In my past lives, I had been either cruel or indifferent to animals, particularly with the horses I rode in battle." After a long pause, "I dislike cats. I am not very kind to my dog. They are here to teach me compassion. I've got to remember this. The teacher is giving me my what-if question, and it's about the treatment of pets." Perhaps at first glance, my client's vision of this activity may not seem of great consequence in the scheme of other karmic issues. This would be a wrong assumption. Jack and I were able to explore his attitude toward the broader issues of kindness and compassion in his life, and how the attributes of animals are capable of enriching our understanding of all living things. Jack does not like pets, but his family insists on having them. On questioning Jack further as to why this spiritual lecturer singled him out for a what-if question involving his treatment of animals in former lives, we discovered it was about prejudice toward what he considered a lower form of life. Since animals are different from us, they are undervalued and taken for granted by some people.